This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. When Stan Lee, the legendary head of Marvel Comics for decades and the co-creator of characters such as the Fantastic Four, the X-Men, and Spider-Man, died a year ago, he wasn't quite done producing content. Earlier this year, an audiobook he co-authored, Trick of Light, was released and immediately became a bestseller on Audible. Trick of Light is a complex and compelling story that follows the adventures of Cameron, a high school senior and would-be YouTube star who gains superpowers after a freak accident on Lake Erie, and Nia, a teenage hacker shrouded in personal mystery. It's a meditation on virtual and augmented reality and, in many ways, how the internet has failed to deliver on its promise of connecting us in more profound ways than we thought we would be able to do with the internet. Now, the print version of Trick of Light is just out, and for today's podcast, I'm excited to be joined by the novel's co-author, Kat Rosenfield. She is the author herself of two highly acclaimed young adult novels, Amelia Ann Is Dead and Gone, and Inland. She's a former reporter for MTV News and a regular contributor to places such as New York Magazine, Wired, and Playboy. She also maintains incredibly lively Twitter and Instagram feeds, practices and teaches yoga in a way that is both inspiring, daunting, and really, really annoying to those of us who are lazy and busy decomposing. We're going to talk about Trick of Light and cyber culture and what it's like to collaborate with a pop culture legend like Stan Lee, and also how cancel culture is infiltrating the literary world, especially among young adult writers. But before I talk with Kat, I want to tell you about a fantastic new documentary style podcast series that takes an in-depth look at the history of the Constitution. It's from the legal minds over at the Institute for Justice, so right away you know it's going to be good. It's called Bound by Oath, and it features interviews with historians, legal scholars, and the real people involved in historic and contemporary cases in front of the Supreme Court. Bound by Oath. Go check it out. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Now back to the show and to Kat Rosenfield. Thanks for talking to Reason, Kat.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Summarize the plot of A Trick of Light.
Okay, this is always tricky because I'm afraid that I'm going to open my mouth and I'm going to accidentally spoil the entire
story.
There
are spoilers. So this is a complicated. We don't normally talk to novelists on the podcast, so it's kind of, don't spoil it, but intrigue
strokes,
the readers.
Right, because, you know, comic book fans or comic book adjacent fans are obviously, they take this stuff very seriously. So you got to be super careful.
That's right.
So broad strokes.
And they
strokes,
are unforgiving and harsh people.
That is true. Yes. That is true.
Sometimes with superpowers.
You don't want to risk it. But, in broad strokes, A Trick of Light is a story centered in digital culture in the internet age. And in it, as you said, we meet a young man named Cameron, who's an aspiring YouTube star. And we meet a young woman named Nia, whose history and origins are a little bit more mysterious. And together, they form a connection that could either change the world, could save the world, or could destroy the world entirely.
Mm. All right. And we'll get into this a little bit more. And the Cameron and Nia story is kind of at the center, but it's a much more complicated and kind of wide-ranging tapestry than that. But you, when the audiobook was released, you told Teen Vogue, and I thought this was a great quote, "The amazing and also terrible thing about the internet is that it's changing the way we relate to each other, even to the point of warping our own sense of who we are. Cameron and Nia are struggling with the same questions and anxieties that we all experience as a result of inhabiting digital spaces where identity and reality become malleable." Can you talk a little bit in general terms before we talk more about the book? Talk about how our identities and our realities are more malleable than they might have been. And, that obviously there's some good things to that and bad things. So just explain that a little bit.
Right. Well, I mean, this was one of the things that really sparked the novel itself. It was something that fascinated Stan, this question of what becomes more real when we're allowed to create our own realities and create identities within those realities that may or may not line up with who we are in real life. And it's like, what is the real you? You know, when you go into this virtual space where you've curated your reality and you've decided who gets to be in there with you, and you get to decide very much how you're perceived online in a way that you can't necessarily in real life. you know, it becomes this question, do you present a more flattering version of yourself? Are you more likable? Are you more provocative? Are you more volatile? And something that I, you know, wanted to explore as we were working on this story, and something that I think is probably a familiar experience to a lot of people, and particularly anybody who works in media, is knowing somebody in real life who's a totally normal, decent person offline. You know, they have a job, they have a family, they have pets, and then they get on Twitter or Facebook and they turn into a fucking monster. It's like, what happened? What happened to you?
Well, and do you think, are they revealing the real me, or are they kind of exploring something, or, you know, how does that work?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of potential explanations for that kind of behavior, where you've got somebody who's just drastically different and meaner online in a way that they would never be in real life. You know, if you encountered them at a party, they would never talk to you the way that they might, you know, on the internet. And I think it has a lot to do with how people feel empowered to behave when there's a screen in between them and the person that they're interacting with. And also when online incentivizes a kind of speech, a kind of interaction that is actually frowned upon if you're doing it face-to-face.
Now, there's also a positive side to this too, right? Where it's particularly if you're a person who is shy, or you might be literally or figuratively disfigured, you can reinvent yourself online. And that's a positive thing, right?
Absolutely. And you can test things out. And mm-hmm. I mean, you know, testing out identities is something that people have been doing since the dawn of time, mm-hmm. you know, and as part of the normal developmental process for a young person or even a not so young person. So online just gives us another forum, maybe over which we have much more control, you know, in which to do that kind of exploration.
Although it's also one of the things that I like about the online space, and I agree with you, you know, there's a lot of trolling out there and a lot of just horrible behavior that wouldn't happen in meet space or, you know, face to face. But then I also love the way that people lose control of their what they put out there. And I'm thinking back to a couple of years ago, and I wrote something about, you know, when Twitter messages or Instagram campaigns get out of control, or the producer, the creator loses control. And Bill Cosby, for instance, had put out a right when he was about, you know, everything in his life was coming down. He had put out, he was doing a comeback, and he had put out a Twitter request saying, like, hey, here are some pictures of me with sweaters from the Cosby Show. Like, would you make some memes? Like, what are your favorite, you know, Cosby memes?
Oh, no.
Right at the moment. And it was, I mean, the hilarity ensued, because it was like, and that happens. And, you know, so it's, I one of the things that I love about the online space and Twitter and Instagram, I think Twitter perhaps more so than Instagram, is just that a lot of times producers, and, you know, and this is kind of like publishers or movie studios, the church, legacy institutions, think they can control the message, and then it just kind of spirals out of control.
That's very true.
Yeah. So that's always fun. So the emotional center of the book, A Trick of Light, is really between Cameron and Nia. And you talk about it, you know, this is, I mean, the many of the main characters are teenagers, but this is not a young adult book. This is much broader, and I would recommend to anybody who is, I mean, if you're into YA stuff, if you're into comic book stuff, if you're into, actually, and this is, you know, to your credit, if you're into kind of literary representation, you know, and you don't necessarily think of like Stan Lee as literary in a certain way, but it is about an exploration of the possibilities of augmented virtual reality, or just kind of creating yourself. What's the, you know, tease people so they want to know more about Cameron and Nia. What's the essential kind of dynamic there?
Well, I mean, Cameron initially is sort of smitten in the way any, I think, young person would be when they encounter online somebody who seems so smart and so cool and so hot, because, you know, Nia is definitely, you know,
he's a high school senior.
Right, exactly. So, yeah. You know, it's like you're 18-year-old.
Who develops can we say what his special power is?
I think that we can say that he develops cyberkinetic powers that allow him to communicate with software. So, but, you know, when he meets her, he feels understood, and he finds a sense of connection. And this is really what the, you know, what we were exploring here was this notion of what has the internet done, not just to our identities and our realities, but also to the way that we interact with other people. How has it changed our connections with each other? Which is something the internet has really changed, and it's still so new. So we're still kind of reckoning with what this does to our relationships when an avatar of you is interacting with an avatar of somebody else. You know, how much trust can be there?
So it's almost like every day is Halloween in a way, and, you know, weird things happen on Halloween.
Right. Halloween plus, you know, then like the kind of person who takes it so seriously that it becomes not even a costume, but performance art. Like, that's the level of possible malfeasance or, you know, disingenuity that you're dealing with. On the other hand, you know, it can also empower you to be more real and more brave in a way that you weren't before. And Cameron is, you know, he's aspiring to be famous on YouTube. And then when he develops these powers, which are a secret, but the accident that happens to him that, you know, that creates this situation, that happens on live stream. So the entire world sees it. And then he becomes famous and he discovers it's not at all what he wanted. He feels more disconnected from everybody else than he ever did before.
Can I ask how old you are?
37.
Okay, you're 37. So you remember a time before, like, 24/7 connectivity.
Oh, absolutely.
It's probably fading, right? Because
I mean, you know, the internet, in high school, towards the end of high school, people started getting AOL.
Right.
And you could instant message people. And this was actually a very interesting thing, that you could have conversations online with people who wouldn't interact with you at school. And I was not popular in high school, but once we had Instant Messenger, some of the boys who were popular found me on there and started talking to me, which I thought was really interesting.
And it's also AOL generally, and then AIM or AOL Instant Messenger. What was great about that is that you could be anonymous, or you didn't AOL compared to, and I'm older than you, I'm 56. I remember a time before that, but where, like, CompuServe, you had to, like, your name was known. It was in every message. You couldn't hide. Whereas AOL, one of the great things about it was you could be anonymous.
So that was the great anonymizer. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And that changes a lot of stuff, right? So how much to, you know, contemporary teenagers or, you know, people who are growing up now don't remember a time where there was only MeetSpace. Is it a fundamentally different experience, do you think, to grow up online where you're simultaneous? I mean, you're in an augmented reality to begin with, and you have your real physical identity and set of friends and family, and then you also have this supplemental space. Is that a different experience than, you know, kind of emerging into an online
I think it definitely
world?
Is in so many ways, and some of them are good and some are bad. You know, I spent 10 years writing this teen advice column at the Spark Notes website. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was fascinating was seeing how, you know, coming up, and as, you know, as social media became more and more ubiquitous, kids got more and more anxious about interacting with each other offline, but also the
or in reality, right? It's funny that, I mean, in a way, maybe on, well, and it, I guess it depends on where the conversation is being housed, but, or hosted, but is online reality the default? And then, you know, offline is kind of like, well, I gotta.
It's a good question. And there's, like, and there's texting, but there's also texting apps, and there's all of these different rules of engagement. You know, did you look at the person's snap that they sent you, and, like, did you respond, and how long was your streak going of you guys looking at and responding to each other's snaps? And apparently that was very significant in ways that I honestly am a little too old, I think, to fully understand.
Did you ever give any obviously ruinous advice as a teen advice columnist?
Ruinous? No, I'm so happy to say that I didn't. I would hear that.
So, like, nobody, you weren't like telling Johnny Walker Lind, yeah, you know, join the Taliban, follow your bliss, or anything like that.
No, didn't do that. One of the interesting things that I addressed related to online culture was the emergence of sexting. And at the time, I mean, I think now that maybe, I mean, especially now that we have, like, deep fake technology,
right.
And also, I mean, is there anybody alive who's not going to have a naked picture of themselves online?
But hoping. The last person has probably been born or has died where that would happen.
Most likely. But, I mean, in the meantime, there was, you know, there was this sexting panic, you know, circa probably 2010, where, you know, suddenly teenagers, of course, were doing what teenagers do, you know, taking pictures of themselves and sending them around. And I just remember being like, look, I understand you're going to do this. You know, this is like, it's a part of exploring your sexuality. Like, you're going to want to, you're going to do it. Just crop out your face.
Right.
Crop out your face, yeah. Please.
And as long as you're not Michael Jackson or Bill Clinton, you know, then nobody would be able to track you.
Yeah, right? Pretty much.
Do you think that, you know, the one technology I'm thinking, because obviously letter writing people, even though it might take weeks for letters to arrive, they were writing sexy letters. I suspect that telegrams or telegraphing, were there like telegraph operators who were sexting? That maybe that's like the only technology where it didn't immediately go to some kind of sexual contact.
God, that must have been difficult just because, I mean, it requires a lot of coordination to like kind of dot, dot, dash your way through
true.
A sexy message. If you lose control, what happens? It gets all mangled.
Like, oh my God, it's a hot flash and you've missed the whole message. You know, one of the great innovations, to go back to A Trick of Light, one of the great innovations that Stan Lee brought to comic books was the creation of like a hero's deep interior life. And, you know, you see this obviously in things like Spider-Man, where Peter Parker is a high school student who is mooning over Mary Jane Watson, and he's constantly being picked on. And, you know, Peter Parker is as or more interesting in a lot of ways than Spider-Man. There's variations of that. You know, the Hulk would be uninteresting if he's just the green monster all the time, as opposed to Bruce Banner, et cetera. There is, you know, in the book, A Trick of Light, I mean, that's kind of interesting, particularly with Cameron, because he is kind of a superhero, even though his power is somewhat hidden and whatnot. But why do we like the idea of having kind of like heroes who are so deeply problematic? I mean, it's, you know, what's the attraction to that, do you think?
I think it's just, you know, it makes for a relatable story. It makes for a relatable character. You know, we see ourselves in these heroes. And like you were saying, you know, I mean, what makes this so much a classic Stan Lee story is that you are dealing with these questions of identity, which have been central to all of his work. You know, Spider-Man, Peter Parker, like, you know, there's this stress between, you know, which one of these am I, and what does it mean for me to be Spider-Man, and what does it mean for my life, you know, my real life? What is my real life?
Right.
But I think that having characters whose struggles mirror our own, you know, maybe in more sort of extravagant or fantastic terms, but, you know, who are still very relatably human, that's what, I mean, not just superhero origin storytelling is about, but what storytelling is about in general. You know, there's something to kind of connect to. What's human on the page speaks to what's human in you.
Talk a bit about the Nia character, which is also interesting. And there's that tradition. I mean, I guess it's a new tradition, but it's a trope that, you know, recurs for obvious reasons. But there's kind of like the female hacker, right? And the mysterious, enigmatic woman who can like do a lot of stuff online and get into databases or, you know, hack things that can't. And so this is like Lisbeth Salander and the Girl with Dragon Tattoo and other things. Every TV shows have like the female hacker who kind of leaves her body behind. What's going on there? And, you know, what is liberating for women in particular to be online and to be kind of simultaneously disembodied and then be in control of how you present yourself?
This is not a question I was expecting to discuss, and okay. I'm not sure what I really have to say about it.
Okay.
Sorry, can I just like...
You can pass on that. Yeah, you don't even have to be shy about passing it.
I mean, I'm just trying to think. I mean, I think the thing is that when you're a woman online, it's not like you really escape, even if you're disembodied, you know... There's always somebody there to remind you that you are, in fact, a woman. And I mean, I should say that there's this narrative out there right now that online is a terrible place for women. It's so much worse for women. And they, you know, they deal with, you know, vast amounts of harassment that men don't. But in my experience, and I think according to, you know, the actual data that's available on this, that's actually not true, but there's a perception that it is. And, you know, it's an interesting question to me why that myth is so persistent. You know, this idea that, like, you know, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog, but everyone knows you're a lady.
Everybody knows you're a bitch.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way, right? Discuss a little bit the kind of collaboration process or the creative process with Stan Lee and your other collaborators. And I mean, one of the things that's fascinating. So, I mean, we're talking about the release of the print edition of the book, which you effectively wrote. I mean, you were in collaboration with other people. And then there was the audio book, which is 12 hours long and is like a pretty amazing kind of, I was going to say it's a spectacle. That's not right. And I'm reaching for it's like this incredibly rich kind of experience as a audio book.
It's like cinema for audio.
Yeah.
I mean, I was fascinated to see, I should say that the print edition of A Trick of Light is mostly the same as the audio original, but we have some bonus material. We have some additional chapters, and there's a foreword by Stan, and I think an afterword by each of my collaborators, Luke Lieberman and Ryan Silbert, talking about the development of the project and what it meant to them. But when we released this for audio, we had Yara Shahidi as a reader, and she did a phenomenal job. But it was incredible to see how the prose is transformed by the performance. Once somebody starts reading it aloud to you, something happens.
How do you feel as an author? Because it's your words, and then it takes on this other kind of life.
Yeah,
right?
It was like it was what I'd written, but it also wasn't. It was, somebody else had interpreted it, and through that filter, it was new. It was fresh to me. I got very excited listening to the story, being like, this is really cool. It's exciting.
Was it daunting? Stan Lee is one of those guys, and I suspect it's more for boys than for girls. But I mean, comic book culture has kind of been blurring. And one of the most fascinating kind of developments, I think, of youth culture more generally, but popular culture in general, is that the kind of binaries of male and female have been merging, and there's a more common audience. Like Comic Cons now are like much, there's a lot more women there than there were 30 years ago. But Stan Lee, along with somebody like Shigeru Miyamoto, the guy who created all the Mario Brothers stuff for Nintendo. I mean, like, Stan Lee is the dream merchant. I mean, like, it's half, so much of our lives are kind of playing out in texts that he wrote or landscapes that he helped create. And they take on a life of their own, et cetera. But I mean, was it daunting to, collaborate with somebody like that?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, it's half intense excitement at being invited to do it and half, intense imposter syndrome. Like, they're going to find out that I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm a fraud. But, what was fun about being brought on board this project, which, started with Stan and Luke wanting to collaborate. They had this long mentorship. They were interested in the internet. They wanted to do something contemporary. And Stan was especially interested in how the internet had kind of failed to deliver on the promise of connecting us. It was initially what made it so exciting. Then it was, has this actually done what it was supposed to do? Or is it driving us apart? Is it making us tribal and isolating us? They started developing this story. And obviously, Stan is like the cosmic space dust from which all things superhero originate, and Luke had a long history with comics. When they brought on Ryan Silbert, filmmaker, also another collaborator, he grew up on comic books. And then when I joined the project, it was because they were looking for somebody who had a different kind of a background, to tap into the dynamics of the character, to make this, like you were saying, a work of literary fiction, not just a long, bloated comic book story.
Do you have like a favorite superhero?
I really love Ant-Man.
Really? What do you love? And this is, I can remember back, this would have been sometime in the 70s or early 80s. It was a Saturday Night Live sketch. John Belushi was still on Saturday Night Live. So that dates it on some level, but there's a superhero party and Ant-Man shows up and, all of the other superheroes are there and they're like, well, who are you? And he's like, I'm Ant-Man. My power is I can shrink to the size of an ant while retaining full human strength. And they're just kind of like, what the hell is that? And then obviously the Paul Rudd movies, their character is very different. But what do you like about Ant-Man?
So there are two things that I like about Ant-Man. The first one is that just from a creative perspective, and the Saturday Night Live sketch that you're referencing really gets into that, is that, when you create a superhero whose superpower is also something that could result in his death like 17 different ways, like the first time he ever shrinks down, that's an amazing challenge. You've written yourself into a corner. I mean, you're starting out in a corner and you have to write your way out of it. How can you make this work? So purely from the perspective of finding creative solutions to something like that, I think that's very exciting. The other thing is, as you were saying, Paul Rudd plays Ant-Man, and I was a teenage girl in the 1990s.
I see. And so say no more.
I have certain feelings about him that, you know, I mean.
And he is perhaps more than any single human being alive has not aged since, at least since being in Clueless. So it's
bizarre. His superpower is that he's clearly a vampire.
Yes, that's right. Your past fiction writing has been in the young adult genre. You've had great success there. And, you know, and your novels are pretty dark. They involve girls being murdered, mothers drowning, that sort of thing. It seems like a lot of the most memorable YA fiction also deals with these supercharged emotional situations. I mean, when you think of Harry Potter, some of the great moments in that are like when he's meditating on the fact that everybody around him is killed almost, you know, with very quickly. You know, the Hunger Games, Divergent series that, you know, that talk about alternative futures, which are always kind of negative and hostile. Why do you think YA fiction is drawn to such dark material?
I mean, I think that it's really about, I mean, your young adult years, it's a dark time. You know, you're contemplating these big questions, I think. And in addition, because everything that's happening is so new, every experience emotionally, whether it's positive or negative, is just cranked up to 11. You know, experience everything so much more intensely when you're young. You know, so the great things that happen to you are the greatest thing that's ever happened to you. And the terrible things that happen to you are the end of the world. It really feels that way.
Who are your YA heroes as novelists, or was there a book or two that you read and you were like, fuck, I want to write something as good as this?
I mean, I ended up in YA sort of by accident, just because the first novel that I ever started working on, which ended up being Amelia Ann Is Dead and Gone, had a teenage protagonist. And at that time, it was just sort of, you know, this is how you end up writing YA. You know, your protagonist is 18 or under and still in high school. And it's not an exact science determining sort of where the boundaries of the genre are. But at the time, that was just sort of where I ended up. But I think that's also, you know, it speaks to the flexibility of it that I was writing a story that was ultimately pretty adult in terms of its thematic material. Like you were saying, it's dark, you know.
and I mean, I urge people to go check it out. Yeah, it's really dark. It's kind of, it's wonderfully dark.
Yeah, actually. I mean, the very first thing that happens in the book is a violent sex scene. So. Yes. You know, it's like, hello, teenagers, here you go.
Right.
But, you know, so in terms of wanting to emulate particular YA novelists, you know, I didn't actually really start reading the genre until after it became clear that I was writing in that genre.
Who are your, more generally than who are your kind of literary forebears?
I mean, I really enjoy Stephen King, as I think, you know, most of us do. I grew up reading him. Starting at a young age, my mother, in a act of desperation because I was going through books too quickly, gave me The Shining when I was about 11 years old. I was terrified of our bathtub for the next 9 years.
Yeah, and that probably, like, you know, staying in hotels becomes kind of dicey after that.
Yeah, a little bit. I always really liked the work of Iris Murdoch, who I discovered more as an adult. In high school, I loved John Irving. The World According to Garp, that was the first time that I had read anything like that and realized that books could be like that.
Yeah. Say a little bit, what do you mean about that? I actually was just thinking about The World According to Garp recently because it's like a powerful novel. And it was a real cultural event, first as a novel and then as a movie when it came out, I guess, novel in the late 70s and the movie in the mid 80s. But
yeah, I wish that I could have experienced what it was like to be sort of part of, you know, to be a grown up when that novel came out and was part of, you know, kind of the zeitgeist in the moment. I came to it, obviously, you know, much later. But the thing that was incredible about it to me was how kind of centered in, you know, it was in a world that felt real and it was irreverent and it dealt with sex, you know, but mm-hmm. like not just, you know, straightforward, oh, we're going to cut away kind of, but, you know, but it, like, I mean, isn't that that's the one where the guy gets his
car accident. Penis bitten off. Yeah.
I mean, it was incredible to read a book that was beautifully written, captivating, that also went there. You know, I really, that was the first time I'd experienced that kind of writing. And up until that point, of course, you know, the stuff that you're reading in school is nowhere near that colorful,
right?
Or that dangerous. Yeah. So yeah, that was really an awakening.
And it's a fantastic book, I mean, it really is a kind of interrogation of the sexual revolution, even as it is an enactment of it and a kind of product of it. So it's, yeah, I mean, there's so much going on there.
Yeah. And it, I mean, it's beautifully imaginative. The characters are so real. I remember being shocked, actually, when it turned out the Ellen Jamesians mm-hmm. were not a real, like, crazy
right.
cult.
Right. And that's a radical feminist group
right.
in the book, which, yeah, it occupies and very, in my experience, very rare. It's rare when a book, it's both in a real world, like one that's very particular and very current and seems like we're living in that world, but then it's also kind of taking place in a fable, like in a mythical America or mm-hmm. a mythical world. Really,
yeah.
Really tremendous. You know, one of the things that you've written a lot memorably, your journalism is about the intersection of political correctness and publishing, particularly in the young adult space. Earlier this year in New York Magazine, you wrote about a mind-boggling incident in which a budding author, and I'm probably going to mispronounce her name, and I apologize for that, but Amelie Wen Zhao, actually canceled a prospective novel she was about to publish, Blood Air, due to a backlash online before the book was written, or I guess before the book was published, maybe even written?
It was on the eve of publication. I think okay. there were ARCs out. So, you okay. know, so the book was done.
Okay. So,
you know,
explain what happened and, you know, what do such actions or this kind of controversy, what does it tell us about where we are currently, you know, at least in terms of kind of cancel culture and online culture?
I mean, you know, the Amelie Wen Zhao situation was crazy and unique, but it also needs to be understood as the culmination of, you know, maybe three to four years of activism in the YA space, where this movement has emerged. It was originally about diversity in publishing, diversity in the YA fiction space, but it really transformed over the course of a few years to be much more about policing content, you know, policing who is allowed to tell certain stories and how they're allowed to tell them along the parameters of identity, you know, racial, religious, ethnic, sexual, and so on. So, you know, there had already been this push and there had been books, you know, coming under fire with campaigns to see them edited or canceled, some successful, some less so.
And this is, I mean, just to kind of put it in a context. So if it's, say, a white author writing about, you know, a slave revolt or something or a historical book, you know, are they... You know, do they have the agency or do they have the legitimacy to write and represent somebody else's
right.
experience?
I mean, that's sort of the main thing now is, you know, stay in your lane. This isn't your story to tell. And that's a predominant sentiment, you know, not necessarily in YA across the board, but amongst this very vocal group of activists who've managed to, for better or for worse, gain quite a lot of influence in the space. So Amelie Wen Zhao, what's interesting about her is that she was a huge diversity success story to begin with. You know, she's a Chinese immigrant. She came to the U.S. at age 18. And she started writing in secret because she felt that her conservative family would not approve of a non-remunerative career path.
She's not going to become a doctor.
Something,
you know,
like that.
She's like, this is kind of a Monty Python sketch where she's hiding the fact that she's a novelist or something.
Yeah, so she's working in finance, I think doing incredibly well for herself. And then she's writing this fantasy novel in secret. So one of the, I think, arguably good and successful initiatives to try and diversify the landscape in terms of who's getting through the door in publishing is this pitching contest called DV Pitch, Diversity Pitch. And it's happening online where, you know, authors from marginalized backgrounds, diverse backgrounds are invited to pitch on Twitter, you know, using this hashtag to try to connect with agents. And this was how she met her agent. And then she sold this novel for like $500,000, which is an unheard of, I mean, just incredible advance in general, but especially in YA. So she was arguably exactly the kind of author who diversity advocates want to see succeed. They should have been on her side when it came to getting this book, you know, out the door and having it be a huge success. So the fact that cancel culture came for her anyway was really an interesting moment, you know, for anybody who's been watching this kind of stuff unfold, to say, well, you know, the people who are advocating for this stuff, like, you should have been on board with this. What is it that you're actually trying to accomplish? You know,
what do you think is going on there? And you know, you say it is a, you know, on a certain level, this is isolated, or it's not clear how representative it is, but there's other incidents. So another author, Kosoko Jackson, who's a gay Black author, canceled his debut novel after being attacked for cultural appropriation. And ironically, he himself had been like a pretty robust enforcer of the idea that, like, if you're not gay, if you're not Black, if you're not this, like, don't write about something that you are not.
And then, you know, that bell tolls for thee.
Yeah.
You know, I think that I have to speculate here, but I think that what we're seeing is a lot of well-intended pushing for solutions that seem like they're going to work. And some of them are good ideas and some of them are not such good ideas. But also we've seen what happens in a space where a lot of people they mean well. They're also very fearful of misstepping. They also sense that it's not their place necessarily to drive the conversation. Publishing is, and YA particularly, is dominated by white women who are generally educated, upper middle class, you know, very anxious about being on the right side of things in terms of, you know, political correctness.
And ironically, as good feminists, as good women, they'll always put somebody else's interests in front of their own. Right?
Isn't that ironic? Oh, yeah. So what you have is an environment where it's very easy for a few manipulative people, grasping people, to get hold of power and to wield it like petty little tyrants, you know, for the purposes of aggrandizing themselves. And I think that's something that you're seeing in cases like Amelie Wenzhou's. You know, that's basically what you're seeing. You're seeing something that's less about promoting good books or promoting diverse authors and more about a few people who have power in the community wielding it to try to hurt the career of an author they don't like.
Yeah, and it's curious too, or it's interesting in some of your work, there is that sense, and it's easy to look at this stuff and get really outraged, but then in 2017, you wrote about Black Witch, a book by an author named Laurie Forrest, who it was preemptively attacked online, and it looked like, you know, and it's always amazing when you see how, you know, even before a book is released, suddenly they'll have like a million negative reviews or zero-star reviews on Goodreads or something that drive things down. But Black Witch actually went on to really good reviews and sales. So it's not immediately clear how powerful the kind of extreme people are in the overall scheme of things.
Right. A lot of it depends on how the author reacts. You know, what was interesting, so Laurie Forrest, the author of The Black Witch, took what I think is ultimately the best possible tack when it comes to having a bunch of people campaigning to cancel your book, which is that she just didn't engage. And she had never kind of been a part of this call out culture, this cancel culture to begin with. So it was easy for her to just kind of ignore what was happening, ignore the noise, and focus on the people who obviously were numerous who did love and appreciate her work, understanding that it was something she had to bear for a few months and then it would be over and they would move on to something or someone else. Amelie Wenzhou, when she chose to cancel her book herself, a big part of this was because she had kind of gone all in on this social justice, you know, calling out other authors, getting into this kind of, you know, I don't want to say spats, that makes it sound trivial, but I guess it kind of is, you know, on Twitter, you know, related to who's allowed to write what and so on. So once she'd put all her eggs in that basket, it's very difficult to extricate them when people start getting upset and kind of calling for your head.
Has anybody appropriated, I'm thinking, you know, in a lot of ways, I mean, and it's decades before YA as a kind of self-conscious category in publishing emerged in the late 60s, but I'm thinking of Catcher in the Rye. Have non-prep school jerk-offs appropriated Holden Caulfield yet and just written endless books about, you know, what it's, how tough it is to be a upper middle class person from New York in the 50s.
I mean, I think that Holden Caulfield is canceled.
Yeah, well, he is kind of, right? I mean, and that not necessarily be out of ideology, but just because the world that he belonged to or described doesn't really exist anymore.
Right. And I mean, now it's like, well, he's an entitled white guy. So, mm-hmm. you know, how seriously can we really take his pathos?
I felt that way reading that in the, I guess, late 70s in suburban New Jersey. So, you know, but I said the world has caught up on that. It's to bring it back to A Trick of Light. You know, what does any of that kind of YA drama type stuff, and again, a lot of it is happening online, so it's kind of, it's online culture, it's internet culture, it's kind of an augmented reality or supplemental space. You know, are there any, you know, what are the tips when you are exploring yourself online? You know, like, you know, it, you know, what are the smart moves and what are the dumb moves, do you think?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, one of the plot points in the book is that after Cameron and Nia team up, you know, with their respective abilities, you know, hacking and otherwise, they make it a point to kind of go after people who are behaving badly online, you know, who are hypocrites, who are cruel, who are victimizing other people. And they're very equal opportunity about it. So I think that, you know... That sounds kind of pat, but the golden rule really applies. You know, I think that overall that you shouldn't be mistreating people or, you know, treating them in a way that you yourself would not want to be treated, you know, and specifically the sort of attacking people, accusing them of bad faith, of there's a lot of mind reading that seems to happen online. People claim to know what somebody else is thinking or what their real motivation is, you know, even if they've said otherwise. And it's a difficult thing because a lot of what happens online is also happening more for an audience than it is for the person that the speech is supposedly being directed at. I mean, I would say overall, like in terms of, you know, how to behave on the internet, to not lose sight of the human being, the individual human being on the other side of a screen, you know, who you are engaging with for the sake of putting on a show.
Mm-hmm. I realize this is kind of an odd question to ask as you are promoting the publication of A Trick of Light, but what do you have cooking? What are your next projects?
Well, we did announce at San Diego Comic-Con a few weeks ago that there's going to be a sequel to A Trick of Light. You know, we're embarking on a fantastic new universe. You know, so A Trick of Light was a superhero origin story, and now we're going to move on to, you know, some more adventures in this same Alliances universe. So that's exciting, and I'm going to be a part of that. Apart from that, I am working on some other stuff that I actually don't want to jinx by talking about.
So. Will the Alliances, I hope that, will they stay in the Great Lakes region?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How did Lake Erie end up being such a central part to this? So it's, you know, if we talk about a place that America has mostly left behind, Lake Erie seems to be one of them.
And it's such a shame because, in fact, Lake Erie has this amazing history of, you know, mystery.
Catching on fire. Yeah. Perch with six or seven eyeballs.
That's one facet, yes, of it. But I mean, there has been, you know, there's like a history of shipwrecks, right, and unusual storms. There was for a long time something called the Erie Triangle where boats would disappear. And this is something that Ryan Silbert, my collaborator, this was really a big part of his contribution to
I suspect he's from Ohio or Western Pennsylvania or something.
I think he grew up on Long Island, but he clearly has, if not a sort of a hometown love, then a deep abiding interest in the Great Lakes region.
That's right.
But we also wanted to make, you know, it was kind of nice to take a story and set it in middle America. You know, this takes place in Cleveland.
Yeah. And it is kind of great. And that's actually an old literary tradition going back at least to Sherwood Anderson, And his stories about Winesburg, Ohio. But Ohio is both, you know, it's like the ultimate normal place. The Midwest is super normal. So it's always great when you have, you know, this kind of strangeness and super weirdness happening.
Yes, that was a lot of fun to play with.
Well, we have been talking, Kat, before we go, what is the best place if people want to follow you on Twitter or Instagram? What are your handles?
I am on both Twitter and Instagram at Kat Rosenfield. It's just my name, KatRosenfield.
All right. Very good. We have been talking with Kat Rosenfield. She is the co-author of A Trick of Light, Stan Lee's last kind of collaboration and product. It's a fascinating story about online culture and its discontent. So, Kat, thanks so much for talking.
Thanks for having me.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.